Gandalf, my old friend, this will be a night to remember.
Broadcasting from the Three Farthing Stone in the Shire, Middle-earth, this is the Secret Fire Podcast, sent to burn at the heart of the world, episode number one. I'm Michael.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Micah.
On this episode, we'll take a look at the prologue to The Lord of the Rings, specifically concerning hobbits. What can we learn about them? What can we learn about ourselves? We invite you to come along, join the fellowship, become a servant of the Secret Fire each week, here on the GCT Network.
Is your Great Commission transmission.
Gentlemen, welcome back to the studio for the official first episode of the Secret Fire Podcast.
All right.
Micah, did you have a good time last week?
I did, yeah.
It had been so long since you were behind a microphone doing some podcasting way back, what did we say, back in March or so of...
2012.
2012, mm-hmm. 5 years ago. And I think last episode turned out really well as an introduction to... The Secret Fire Podcast. If you haven't listened to that, friends, go to gctnetwork.com and you'll find us there on the front page, or here's a short link for you, gctnetwork.com/SPF000 for the Secret Podcast.
That's right.
Secret Podcast.
The Secret Fire
Fire Podcast. Shh. Did you have anything that, any addendums or anything that needed to be added to the last episode? Thoughts?
Nah.
I'm sure we didn't cover everything, and this show will work itself out over the course probably of about 10 episodes, mm-hmm. as we are figuring, getting our podcast feet, our fire feet, our secret fire feet.
No,
you don't like that?
Too many F's.
No, you don't like that?
Fire feet.
None of that, huh?
Who is that odd little fellow?
Well, I suppose you thought that was terribly clever, didn't
I
you?
I did think that it was terribly clever, but I don't know where
it is. I suppose you think that was terribly clever.
Hey, a note on this episode. Micah is, as I'm turning up the sounds here for in-game sounds, Micah is quite busy this week with theater. Last night was opening night for...
Matchmaker.
The Matchmaker, yes. How'd that go?
It went well, I guess, for opening nights.
Are opening nights generally...
Yeah. Just like that.
They're generally?
Yeah. Opening nights are the nights where you realize, man, if we really just had a couple more weeks
on
the show.
Yes. That's what Brendan is famous for saying on Finding Christ in Cinema. Speaking of Finding Christ in Cinema, we just finished episode number 125 here in the studio. Brendan and I talked about, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh Brother, why did we wait so long
for that,
to do
movie.
That movie?
But the last week we covered... The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was episode number 124, and Micah was a guest on that episode. We had a great time talking about that film. So now we have, on our other show, Finding Christ in Cinema, we have covered all six of Peter Jackson's Middle-earth films. Getting back to Micah, though, last night being opening night, he realized, wait a second, I'm not going to be able to make the show. The Secret Fire Podcast, because generally we're going to be recording on Friday evenings here, and so we postponed the show until Saturday in order to have Micah on this episode. So, nothing else to talk about from the last week. What are we going to do on this very first episode?
Oh, we're talking about the prologue of the Fellowship of the Ring.
Yes, to the Lord of the Rings.
Well, to the whole trilogy.
Right, yeah. Which it's technically not a trilogy, it's technically one book. So,
okay.
Tolkien was very adamant about that. It was just broken up into three parts, and then actually separate books within each of those three parts.
Oh. You know,
book one, book two, book three. Hmm. Right? So it's all confusing. We'll talk about that as the show goes on. It's going to be a lot of discovery going on the Secret Fire Podcast. But prologue as a primer. Let's talk about prologues. In general, there's prologues for films, there's prologues for TV shows, there's prologues for books, there's prologues for anything that's story-driven, right?
Yeah.
What comes to mind when you think prologue?
Well, when I think of prologue, as you've already said, prologue to me is a primer for the rest of the story as it's about to unfold. We've got a newcomer like me who I've seen the movies, but I haven't read the books, and we all know that the books are... Better.
Superior.
Yeah,
vastly.
Of course. And what prologues do, and not just for Middle-earth or Lord of the Rings, but prologues prepare the audience for what's about to come on.
Okay.
For what's about to happen.
Is it planting some seed?
It's planting some seeds. Specifically, I think just because of the way I understand Tolkien, which again, a very limited understanding.
Well, we can go ahead and say that right now you have a rudimentary understanding of his writings.
Yes. Okay. Yes. But I think he is preparing readers like me as he's preparing us to understand the whole span of Middle-earth through the eyes, through the lens, through the worldview of a hobbit.
All right.
He's preparing us because Frodo in this series, Frodo is an integral character. Frodo is the one might say the protagonist. That could be arguable. We'll have to read and find out.
We'll find out.
I'll have to read and find out. You guys already know. But or do you?
I don't know.
I saw that gleam in your eye. I saw that gleam.
You know me. I don't know anything.
Is he the protagonist? but we're seeing, and the same thing with The Hobbit, the book. We saw that story through Bilbo.
Right.
We're seeing this through, well, in a way, kind of through Frodo.
So as experienced by?
As experienced by
that guy,
yeah, you know, Elijah Wood. We're seeing this world through him, and with the prologue, by giving this backstory of hobbits, I have an inkling that there are going to be something.
You get a point.
Thank you.
Oh,
am I catching up?
Yes.
Hey, that takes me out of the hole, right?
No, now we're even.
Okay, good
for the day.
It lets this world be more accessible to new readers and to newcomers to this world.
Okay. Really, because Tolkien was not assuming that everybody had read The Hobbit.
And I got that impression.
Yes.
Like he's saying, okay, even if you have read The Hobbit, I'm going to start from the beginning of the story of these hobbits, how they came to be, how they came to the Shire.
Hey, if you have read an early version of The Hobbit, I need to correct some information for you.
Oh, go ahead.
And so we'll do that. No. That's part of the purpose of this prologue.
Oh, well, there you go.
When we get to, you know, the finding of the ring, he has to make some corrections from the earliest versions,
right.
editions of The Hobbit. Go ahead. Keep going.
Well, he's preparing us that way later on in the story when things happen. I, as a newcomer, can still get almost a par level to what you two might get, having been familiar with it for so long.
Catching you up to speed.
Yes, it's a way to provide what some people call intertextuality.
Okay. That's like a $5 word, right?
A $7 word.
Wow.
Intertextuality. Yeah. Think about it like this. With ancient Greek dramas.
Yes.
Oedipus Rex, case in point, written by Sophocles in 400 to 200 BC, somewhere in there, whenever he lived. Don't quote me on that.
Well, let's remind listeners let's catch listeners up to speed who may not have heard our introductory episode. Brendan is a theater arts major.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah, sorry.
Last semester, you went through Oedipus Rex, the by Sophocles.
As written by Sophocles.
Yes.
Yes. Sophocles wrote that as a culmination of centuries worth of lore regarding the character of Oedipus.
Ah. Really? He's compiling the...
Oedipus himself is a mythological character. Now, some would argue that he's actually based on someone of history. But even still, centuries have passed since the happenings of the story, and he has been blown up into this huge, huge mythological figure. The culture of the Greek people would have been familiar with that.
Right.
So to see,
it's part of their culture.
Yes, yes. So to see the drama of it happen on stage, they will get all of these nuances that were already inherent to the culture, and Sophocles didn't have to spend time explaining those things.
That's a lot like Paul on Mars Hill.
It's a
speaking to the Areopagus.
Yes, yes.
He's speaking to their culture. They understood what he's saying. We're the ones that have to dig.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Shakespeare did it a lot, too.
All right.
Shakespeare did it a whole heck of a lot. Specifically, what comes to mind is... Oh, what did we just read? A Midsummer Night's Dream. Midsummer Night's Dream.
Which one?
No, the play.
Oh,
not the Kevin Kline movie.
No specific Midsummer's Night Dream, just a...
No, just any old one.
With, nondescript.
None of them. a better example would be Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar, again, centuries before Shakespeare penned the play, but when Shakespeare pens the play, the culture is already permeated with the stories and the lore and the
right.
and the so ons and so
they
forth.
They already possessed yeah. the story, the yeah. pieces.
Elizabethan culture was obsessed with the what they would even call ancient Roman culture, which is where we find Julius Caesar. So they already knew what was going on. The Greek people already knew what was going on with Oedipus. Tolkien wants to get newcomers up to speed with what's already going on in Middle Earth regarding hobbits. That way, when those poignant points come up later in the show, in the books,
and on the show,
you know, meta description, we're already caught up to speed,
right?
And it's a good thing.
That's awesome.
I don't want to miss anything because I know how rich this story will be.
Oh,
what did
Peter Kraft say about it? He put it on the same level as Homer and Virgil and Dante and yeah. Milton.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the four that he named off, the four authors. And that's a pretty high pedestal.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait, Brendan, as you are going through this story for the first time to see if it does, if Peter Kraft was correct.
He probably was.
After his
like a smart guy. Viewing.
Okay, great introduction and explanation of what a prologue is, what we can get from it, why they exist. They don't always, they're not everywhere. Some stories don't require them, right?
No, a lot of the, I would dare say the popular stuff, the mainstream popular stuff.
Pulp novels and...
Yeah.
Well, what does the word novel mean anyway? Something new, right? Wow. Hey, Micah, these sounds that we're hearing coming from Lotro right now, where are we? Are we at the...
We're at the Three Farthing Stone in the Shire.
There we go. That's where we begin the show here.
Well, that's where we're actually broadcasting from, right?
Yes.
That is. And that is the stone that marked the demarcation of three of the farthings. Of course, there's four farthings in the Shire. But this one has the East Road going through. And so it's able to connect the west, east, and south farthing. The north farthing's kind of on its own a little bit up there. Let's learn a little bit more about maybe about the Shire, a little bit about hobbits. Let's jump into that prologue, Brendan. What did you think when you were reading this prologue? Did it seem superficial and surface level?
Well, it did. But again, it's like Hobbits 101.
You right?
I mean, because I'm seriously being introduced to this this folk.
Yeah.
This this community of people that have their own ways of life. They have their own ways of doing things, and it's giving me. I mean, yeah, it's very introductory level, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I appreciate it.
For me,
it's going to help me out.
But it has a weight to it.
Yeah.
A lot of weight. It has mass. You know what I'm saying?
Gravitas.
It does. It has the illusion of history.
Yeah.
Now, we...
And that's actually... It's funny you use the word history because that's what Peter Kraft brings up. He says Tolkien liked history better than...
Allegory.
Allegory,
that
yeah.
was the quote that we brought up on the first episode, well, I should say on the zero episode,
yeah.
the introductory episode, that famous quote from Tolkien that I'm going to paraphrase. You know, I dislike allegory and all of its manifestations, and I have since I was old enough to realize that's what was going on. That's part of his...
The foreword.
Yes, it yeah. is. Second edition.
I have it right here.
Okay.
But you've already said it, so...
And he says, I much prefer history... feigned or real.
Yeah, yes.
And that's what this is. Mm-hmm. This is history. And this is really, you're right, this is a slice. This is superficial. This is surface level, because when we get into the Silmarillion and we get into the Lost Tales and these other writings, these other collections that Christopher Tolkien, God bless him, has spent his entire life curating and caring for his father's creation. Mike, any thoughts about the that weight of history that's behind.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, not to say that hobbits have like a shallow culture or anything, but actually, compared to some of the other races and what has been written about them, it's pretty light, actually, compared to, for say, the Numenoreans and stuff.
Well, and that's exactly why the prologue is so important. What I did, and this is what I encourage all listeners to the Secret Fire podcast to do, is get a copy of The Lord of the Rings that you feel comfortable with highlighting. Okay, I want you to mark up your books. I'm actually, right now, I'm using a Kindle version. I got a Kindle version a couple of weeks ago so that I could do this, because this also makes it easy for me to share pieces of from the show on our Facebook and our Twitter pages, or pieces from the text. So I'm looking at my Kindle version here, full blown, with all these different highlights, and starting right from the beginning, the prologue, concerning hobbits. You know, this book is largely concerned with hobbits, Tolkien writes, mm-hmm. and, which is what you were saying as the protagonist, or seeing this story unfold, this drama play out.
It's almost like an audience surrogate type of relationship.
Oh boy, isn't that right? I mean, Tolkien, there's quotes of him saying, you know what, I'm a hobbit. And explaining the ways how he's so similar to hobbits. And mm-hmm. in fact, in his letters to the publishers, as they keep asking him, please give us a sequel to The Hobbit, you know, he'll write letters back. Hey, I mean, the story, The Hobbit was, it was done. The story mm-hmm. was done. When I wrote the end, it really was the end. Bilbo lived the rest of, you know, happily ever after through, for the rest of his days. And so he had to really think, well, how can I give them some kind of a sequel? And it's not going to be a juvenile story or a children's story as the Hobbit was, as it's unfolding before his very own eyes. He's discovering this history.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really, as a sidebar, I think that this story benefits so greatly from the fact that he's a philologist. So, not, you know, language, the history of language, mm-hmm. where did it come from? What did it stem from? What words are borrowed from who and whom? And, you know, that and this, that's actually covered in the prologue. Yep. This prologue, though, it's only 15 pages long, and it is, you know, just a slice off the surface.
Mm-hmm.
This is so thick that it gives you an idea of, oh my goodness, what am I going to find in the other writings?
What iceberg is ahead of me?
Yes. You know? And am I going to run aground on it?
Right.
He says, and from its pages, a reader may discover much of their character and, going to Micah's point, a little of their history. Further information will also be found in the selection from the Red Book of Westmarch that has already been published under the title of The Hobbit.
Yes. Yeah.
The Red Book of Westmarch. Just that name. I mean, the name in and of itself. What kind of images are conjured up in your mind when you hear the Red Book of Westmarch?
I hear a story that was fought for.
Oh,
just the word march. It has that
the what?
You know, West. I don't know.
You'll find out.
I don't know what Westmarch
is. It's the West Marches.
So
it's a territory.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
where in Middle Earth is it?
West of the Shire.
West.
That's
okay.
The West Marches.
See if I can see it here.
Oh, well, it's actually, Micah, that's when we're going to the Yule Festival from Mickle Delving. That's the direction that we're headed up to.
All right.
Cool. Micah is, where are you now?
Are you still at the Three Farthing Stone?
I'd like you to go ahead and make your way, to Mickle Delving.
Well, let me call my horse here.
That's a good whistle.
That's so cool. That is so cool.
Yeah. And we're on our way.
There we go. And
I'm
loath to keep making sidebars or interjecting here with additional information, parenthetical information, mm-hmm. so to speak. But we are on the Arkenstone server, and we invite you folks, anytime that you know that we're live, come and join us. You know, we'll always tweet out and all that stuff. When we're about to go live, you can join us in-game at the Three Farthing Stone in the mm-hmm. Shire, mm-hmm. and then we will travel from there. You can follow Micah around. The story was derived from earlier chapters of the Red Book, composed by Bilbo himself. The Red Book of Westmarch. He was the first hobbit to become famous in the world at large. See, now we're getting hints. Micah, it was so apropos that you said that their history that we have is doesn't stack up in grandeur, I guess, or scope, I should say, to such as the Numenoreans.
Well, yeah, so, he wanted them to be a simple folk, so just keep all that they do simple, you know?
Hobbits are an unintrusive but very ancient people. More numerous formerly than they are today, for they love peace and quiet and good tilled earth. A well-favored and well-farmed countryside was their favorite haunt. What are we learning about hobbits? I think Tolkien described them as simple English country folk.
Yes.
Their height is variable, ranging between 2 and 4 feet of our measure. Now, I should have had you go up to Brock and Boring's.
Well, that's a ways away.
I know it is. because according to the Red Book, Bandabris Took, also known as Bull Roarer, son of Esumbrus.
He actually got up to what, 4 feet tall?
Up to 4 foot, to five.
And he could ride a horse.
Yes. But you know what? We're going to learn about some other hobbits that even exceeded his height. Mm. Oh, and how that comes about. But you'll have to stick around, Brendan, until we get further on in the book.
Oh, okay. Way further on if you're thinking what I'm thinking.
Yeah, we are thinking the same thing. Okay, so they seldom wore shoes since their feet had tough, leathery soles and were clad in a thick, curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, right, which was commonly brown. What is... People that didn't read The Hobbit or the Red Book of Westmarch, what is Tolkien doing for them right now?
He's letting them identify with relate to characters.
Yep. This is what they look like. What their character.
They look like.
Yep.
They look like me.
They're kind of homebodies. They like to do things, right? The only craft little practiced among them was shoemaking. Why? Because their feet. Had these tough soles, and they were covered with that thick, curly brown hair.
Well, that, and according to old Meriadoc, old Toby.
Yeah. Oh, they were covered with old Toby.
Well, no, that, no, they weren't covered with it.
Hey, now you're getting into.
I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead. Concerning pipeweed,
but yeah, so, pipe lore.
but it's just funny. Meriadoc says, smoking old Toby is like the only. Craft that we can the only art that we invented ourselves.
Yes.
So why? Like, oh, yeah,
let's get to that in just a moment. It is plain indeed that in spite of latter estrangement, hobbits are relatives of ours. Now, what I like, you find in this description that it mentions nothing about their ears. What do we notice about their ears in the movies? Anybody?
They are pointy.
Oh, yeah.
And it has led some folk to say Tolkien never said that they had pointy ears. And that is not true. I didn't pull it up. I should have. But it's in the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien in one of the letters, one of the correspondence between he and his publishers. And this was when Houghton Mifflin from America contacted his publishers, Unwin and or however you say it. But anyway, in England, said, we want to publish that book here in the States. And this whole back and forth about artwork was going on because Tolkien provided the artwork, but he was very modest about his artistic abilities, saying, yeah, I'm not really good. I think his artwork is brilliant, absolutely genius. But he was much more modest about it. But so he sent a little description. Hey, well, tell them that, this is what hobbits look like, and described them and said that their ears are pointish, like an elf's. Mm-hmm. So, we do know that they were supposed to have pointy ears. So, Peter Jackson and his team did their homework. Let's read everything that has any description about hobbits, or any description about anything, in order to make sure that we have this right. Okay, so we are relatives of hobbits, but what exactly our relationship is can no longer be discovered. Mm. I love that mystery.
Yeah, it's mystery.
Mm-hmm. And even in mystery, that leaves a vacuum that is going to suck in things such as our own imagination, mm-hmm. right? Doesn't mm-hmm. your imagination immediately go into that little black hole?
Yeah, or as J.J. Abrams would say, the mystery box.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about that mystery box.
Well, it's just a lot more fun for the audience to imagine what's inside the box instead of actually opening the box and finding out. He says this in a TED Talk that he delivered in 2008, back when Lost was at the peak of its prime, you know, Lost. And what is the island? We will never know. But he wanted to keep it like that because he knew that the audience would love thinking of their own ways of what the island is instead of actually giving an answer from himself.
Yes.
Because once he did that, then it would completely ruin in his way of saying it, ruin the audience experience.
That type of mystery acts as a vacuum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sucks in your imagination. Yet it is clear that hobbits had, in fact, lived quietly in Middle-earth for many long years before other folk became even aware of them. But in the days of Bilbo and Frodo, his heir, they suddenly became, by no wish of their own, both important and renowned, and troubled the councils of the wise and the great. Of course, we are dealing with the third age of Middle-earth. And as Tolkien goes on, they're now long past, and the shape of all lands has been changed, but the regions in which hobbits then lived were doubtless the same as those in which they still linger. The northwest of the Old World, east of the sea. Of their original home, the hobbits, in Bilbo's time, preserved no knowledge.
So wait, northwest of the Old World, east of the sea.
Yeah.
So the part of the map that's not on the map is what you're saying.
No. Okay. I don't have a map.
Well, because if it's a globe, then it's circular and it just goes back around.
There's west. When you sail off west, you get to some amazing places that we know very little about.
There's a map behind you there.
Oh, well, hey.
There we hey.
What do you know?
Nice big one, too.
That is giant, but I can't crane my neck around while I'm talking on the microphone here.
Man.
Oh, it's just absolutely amazing. Okay, so I'm going to move on now that my neck has a crimp in it. Their own records began only after the settlement of the Shire, and their most ancient legends hardly looked further back than their wandering days. That's capitalized, wandering days. Their earliest tales seem to glimpse a time when they dwelt in the upper vales of Anduin between the eaves of Greenwood, the great, and the Misty Mountains. Why they never undertook the hard and perilous crossings of the mountain into Eriador is no longer certain. There's a lot we don't know. But before crossing the mountains, the hobbits had already become divided into three somewhat different breeds. The Harfoots. Remember Harfoots. Okay, that's important to us. The Stoors. And we may talk about the Stoors further on in the story. And the Fallowhides.
My favorite.
Why are the Fallowhides your favorite?
I don't honestly even know.
Okay, well, let's learn a little bit more about these three kinds. The Harfoots were browner of skin, smaller and shorter, and they were beardless and bootless.
So dwarves?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Oh, in fact,
is that too soon?
No. The hobbits that we're concerned with mm-hmm. are Harfoots.
Oh, okay.
Mainly.
Oh, okay.
Mainly, because Micah, kind of alluding to the Fallowhides, will get something
here. I like them
here.
Because they're less fat. There we go.
Okay, here we go. They preferred highlands and hillsides. The Stoors were broader, heavier in build. Their feet and hands were longer, and they preferred flatlands and riversides.
Mm.
Oh, Brendan, remember that. But we know from the films, hobbits don't like water. Oh, right. But wait a second. It's more specific. One kind of hobbit. The Harfoots. Why? Well, you have that look on your face. Interject.
Well, because
anytime.
I'm just thinking
it's your
of
show.
I'm thinking of the prologue to the third film where we see
ah, we're going to leave that little mystery hanging there.
No, answer it.
No!
Dagummit.
Okay, should I?
No.
Should I break my
gun? We'll cross that bridge okay. when we get there.
Keep oh. it, yeah.
Okay. We'll play that close to our chest.
Yeah. There, right? Hey, oh, hey.
Our best, or whatever that saying is.
There you go.
All right. Phalohides were fairer of skin and also of hair, and they were taller and slimmer than the others. They were lovers of trees and woodlands. So the Harfoots had much to do with the dwarves, in the ancient times, and long lived in the foothills of the mountains. Skipping on down, they were most inclined to settle in one place, and longest preserved their ancestral habit of living in tunnels and holes. Our Harfoots most inclined to settle in one place. Let's skip forward a little bit more here. Even in Bilbo's time, the strong Phalohidish strain... Oh, wait a second. I need to back up. The Phalohides were the least numerous, were a northerly branch. They were more friendly with elves and the other hobbits than the other hobbits were, and had more skill in language and song than in handicrafts. That's pretty neat. You like that, huh?
Yeah.
Brendan just perked up. They were artists. Well, anything that you do is an art, according to the Greeks, right?
Of course.
Well, and there's the art of pipe smoking.
If there's a technique to it, it's yes. an art.
They crossed the mountains north of Rivendell and came down the River Horwell. In Eriador, they soon mingled with the other kinds, we're talking Phalohides, right, that had preceded them, but being somewhat bolder and more adventurous... I'm stopping a pregnant pause there.
Oh.
Being somewhat bolder and more adventurous, they were often found as leaders or chieftains among the clans of the Harfoots or Stores.
Okay.
Even in Bilbo's time, the strong Phalohidish strain could still be noted among the greater families, such as the Tooks and the Masters of Buckland, Pippin and Merry.
Merry, yeah.
Skipping down, most of their earlier settlements, we're talking about our Harfoots. Most of their earlier settlements had long disappeared and been forgotten in Bilbo's time, but one of the first to become important still endured, though reduced in size. This was at Bree and the Chetwood that lay round about, some 40 miles east of the Shire. Now, am I understanding this properly? That hobbits founded the town of Bree and the Chetwood? Micah, we'll get there when we make our way to Bree in the books. So there's a question for listeners out there.
Hey.
In those days, they also forgot whatever languages they used before and spoke ever after the common speech, the Western, as it was named, that was current through all the lands of the kings from Arnor to Gondor. Yet they kept a few words of their own, and as well as their own names of months and days and a great store of personal names out of the past. Now we get into this section where he's talking about Shire Reckoning, how the hobbits tell time. Well, in the 1601st year of the Third Age, the Phalohide brothers... Are you looking at a map?
Yeah, I'm comparing maps, yes.
In your book to the one on my wall?
Uh-huh.
The Phalohide brothers, Marcho and Blanco, set out from Bree. They led a great following of hobbits. They passed over the bridge of stone bows that had been built in the days of the power of the North Kingdom, and they took all the land beyond to dwell in. Now we're talking the Shire.
The Shire, okay.
So you have these two Phalohide brothers that... You know, the Phalohides like to intermingle in with the Harfoots and the Stores because they were a smaller group in number. But you got these two guys, and the Phalohides tend to be chieftains, leaders.
Yeah.
Remember that. So anyway, they took all the land to dwell in between the river and the Far Downs. Thus began the Shire Reckoning, for the year of the crossing of the Brandywine, as the hobbits turned the name, became year one of the Shire, and all later dates were reckoned from it. So really, when you have a Third Age date, if you subtract 1600, it'll give you a Shire Reckoning year. So when we have a...
I just said, okay.
Okay, so when we have a year with SR behind it, we're talking Shire Reckoning.
Yes. Okay.
And a TA is Third Age, or whatever the corresponding age is. SA, Second Age.
Mm-hmm.
But after this happened, they soon passed once more out of the history of men and elves. What are we learning about hobbits? For the most part. So the land was rich and kindly, and though it had been long deserted when they entered it, it had been before well-tilled, and there were the king had once had many farms, cornlands, vineyards, and woods. The hobbits named it the Shire, as the region of the authority of their thane, right? That's their leader. And a district of well-ordered business. And there, in that pleasant corner of the world, they plied their well-ordered business of living, and they heeded less and less the world outside, where dark things moved, until they came to think that peace and plenty were the rule in Middle-earth, and the right of all sensible folk. That's where I want to stop for a moment.
So, wait a minute. Are you saying that the hobbits of the Shire are living under a delusion?
Yeah. They are.
Hmm.
Because they don't have dealings with the outside world, and so therefore they think that the way that they live, that's the way all it's, sensible...
It's the rule.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the standard.
It's how everybody is.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be gleaned from that.
Yeah.
Especially for Christians. Because, Brendan, this really reminds me, to tie back to our other show, Finding Christ in Cinema, this reminds me a lot of what we discussed all of last year, as a matter of fact.
Pretty much.
It was an overarching theme, though undesigned on our part. Johnny Cash taught us something. What was it? What did we talk about so much?
I was talking about, shine your bright light, and shine it you should.
Yes.
But you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. Which, being earthly good, is really what we understand Jesus' call for us, is to be of earthly good.
Absolutely. See, Mr. and Mrs. Hops, Judy's parents, who lived in Bunnyboro.
Of Zootopia.
Zootopia.
The film Zootopia.
They didn't want Judy to go to Zootopia and to be a police officer. Why is that?
Well, Zootopia being the huge urbanite city.
Yes.
As opposed to Bunnyboro, which is, well, akin to the Shire.
Very much.
Small countryside.
Sensible folk.
Sensible folk. You know, good, wholesome.
Like plain food.
Mayberry.
Yes.
Mayberry.
Yes.
We're not talking about Raleigh. We're talking about Mayberry.
And you know what is in Zootopia? They're foxes.
Thugs.
Bad people.
Foxes who are thugs.
Yes.
A lot of people who are jerks.
There are fell beasts.
In real life.
Foul creatures and the real world.
Yeah.
The real world that these hobbits were living in, this delusion, separated from the real world. They were not shining their light.
Mm-hmm.
Because they assumed everybody's like us.
Yeah.
Everybody wants the same thing as us. And Brendan, to speak to your point, let's go to Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16. Of course, this is the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to take this reading out of the New Revised Standard Version, the NRSV. Jesus says, "You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid." Who's he talking to? Everybody that's listening to him there, right? Is he excluding anybody? "You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." The hobbits were being no middle earthly good.
Yeah. Yeah, that, there you go. There's the pun.
They were living this great life. Let's liken that to Christians. That we want to live these insular lives.
Mm-hmm.
We watch Christian movies, and we listen to Christian music, and we listen to Christian news, and, you know, we do...
Vote Christian politics?
We vote for... Yeah, exactly. Just we do it, all these things that are insular and unaware of the world outside.
Well, we like our bubble.
Yeah, well, it's comfortable, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Because you know what's outside that bubble?
Uncomfortable.
Foxes, in the case of Zootopia. But in the case of Middle-earth, what's outside of that shire? They were unaware that they were being protected this whole time. There were watchers. There were guardians that were protecting them. See, at no time had hobbits of any kind been warlike, and they had never fought among themselves, as we're reading more from the prologue. The last battle before this story opens, and indeed the only one that had ever been fought within the borders of the Shire, was beyond living memory, and that was the Battle of Greenfields. That's right above the statue of Bull Roarer Took.
I can head to the Greenfields now.
No, we're going to head over to the Matham House if you want.
Oh, I'm there.
Yeah. Why not? Good. And that took place in Shire Reckoning 1147, in which Bandabris Took routed an invasion of orcs, right? That's where we're going to get the game of golf. We heard about that.
Oh, that's, yeah.
I believe you made that up. What was Gandalf's response to that?
I can't remember.
You know, maybe. But, you know, it's talking about the power of story.
Yeah.
That's a great line. We may need to clip that for our sound cart for this very show. So though there was still some store of weapons in the Shire, these were used mostly as trophies hanging above hearths or on walls or gathered into the museum at Mickle Delving, the Matham House. It was called for anything that hobbits had no immediate use for, but were unwilling to throw away. Was called a Matham. Ha ha! Micah, describe the Matham House for us.
Well, it's a building, so obviously it's not a tunnel, but it's about three stories and many round windows. And if I enter, there are many, many trophies from all around. There's portraits and of famous hobbits and paintings of landscapes and weapons hanging on walls, everything that hobbits just love to keep around.
That was their museum. Okay. And in fact, for many years, it housed that mithril chainmail.
Chainmail, yes.
That Bilbo received from the dwarves, part of his share
of the treasure.
Of the treasure.
Yeah. His 1/14th share.
Yeah. Yep. Which, unbeknownst to him, as the text tells us, that shirt in itself was worth more than all the Shire combined. It was housed in the Matham House. I love that. That tells us more, something else about hobbits as well. And they were perhaps so unwearyingly fond of good things, not least because they could, when put to it, do without them and could survive rough handling by grief, foe, or weather in a way that astonished those who did not know them well. See, we just took a little bit of a turn. We went from these people that want to live in this bubble. Mm-hmm. They want to believe that everything is like the Shire and things. You know, don't go where there's foxes, stay where you are. But now we learn a little bit about that comes into play in this story. There's a reason, purpose. Reason why Tolkien wrote that there. Was it, you know, tell us more about our hobbits. Okay, real quick, all hobbits originally lived in holes in the ground, so they believed, and in such dwellings they still felt most at home. But in the courses of time, they had been obliged to adopt other forms of abode. Micah, head over to Tookland, I guess, up there, the Great Smiles. They, here comes that horse. Actually, in the Shire in Bilbo's days, it was, as a rule, only the richest and the poorest hobbits that maintained the old custom.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's quite a dichotomy. But suitable sites for these large and ramifying tunnels, or smiles, as they called them, that's S-M-I-A-L-S. They were not everywhere to be found, and in the flats and the low-lying districts, the hobbits, as they multiplied, began to build above ground. I love the information that he's giving readers in this prologue. For folks that did not read The Hobbit, and even for folks that did, this is a lot of new information. We can talk more about the folks that lived by the Brandywine. They were well known to be stores in a large part of their blood, right? So we're talking Buckland.
Mm-hmm.
Help me out here, because there's a lot to read. There's a lot to go through. What things stuck out to you?
Here. I should have been reading along with you.
Oh, no. I'm jumping all over the place. All these different things that I have highlighted. It's so, you know, talking about their houses were usually long, low, and comfortable. The oldest kind were indeed no more than built imitations of smiles thatched with dry grass. So even when they were building houses, they were fashioned. And I think that in Lotro, Micah, don't you think they did an excellent job of portraying that?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The freestanding houses... we'll see that in Crick Hollow, right, when we get there in just a few chapters. How's your horse doing?
It's pretty well. It's a bit tired, but I've reached the smiles. So.
All right. Describe the great smile.
Well, the main house, the main hole, I suppose, is surrounded by a hedge. And on this hill are about, like, 16 different hobbit holes, I see.
Huh. Are they smaller?
Yeah.
Is it the poor folks? The poorer folks? Because again, remember, only the richest and the poorest.
And the poorest, yeah. And yeah, like you said, that is a weird pairing.
Well,
dichotomy.
But he goes on to say how the rich ones, such as Bag End, Bilbo's home that his father built for his mother, and mostly with her money, right? Spectacular. Whereas the poor folks' homes were really a hole in the ground, you know?
Well, there you go.
So it is interesting. There's a whole study in there about appearances and things such as that.
Well, keeping up appearances.
Well, yeah.
Maintaining that.
Oh, we're just hobbits. Delusion. We're just hobbits living in a hole in the ground.
Well, we don't know anything about
of
that.
Of course, man. You know, it's a mansion.
Yeah.
Right? All hobbits were in any case clannish and reckoned up their relationships with great care. They drew long and elaborate family trees with innumerable branches. Right. So in dealing with hobbits, it is important to remember who is related to whom and in what degree. Mike, are you inside the Great Smiles?
I am in the Library of the Great Smiles.
Oh, see? Let's go ahead and skip back here to the end of the prologue. Micah, you stay where you are. We need to talk a little bit more about the Red Book before we wind up this episode, because we are running long. And listeners, you have to let us know how long you want these episodes to be. Do you just want us to get in and out, or do you want to do some exploring? The Red Book. How about note on Shire records here? At the end of the Third Age, the part played by the hobbits and the great events that led to the inclusion of the Shire in the Reunited Kingdom awakened among them a more widespread interest in their own history. And many of their traditions, up to that time still mainly oral, were collected and written down. Now, of course, this book, this account, Tolkien writes, of the end of the Third Age is drawn mainly from the Red Book of Westmarch. Skipping down, Frodo brought it back to the Shire together with many loose leaves of notes. And during Shire Reckoning 1420 through 1421, he nearly filled its pages with his account of the war. But annexed to it and preserved with it, probably in a single red case, were the three large volumes bound in red leather that Bilbo gave to him as a parting gift. So here's the Red Book. right? Here's there and back again. Here, Frodo, my lad. Now you write your part, right?
Mm-hmm.
In it, but he also gave him these three other volumes that were bound together. Oh, and there's also this stuff, which I believe is where the Silmarillion came from, Lost Tales, right?
Hmm.
Things such as that, because Bilbo, that's what he was doing in Rivendell. Okay, and then it was kept. The original Red Book has not been preserved, but many copies were made, especially of the first volume, for use of the descendants of the children of Master Samwise. The most important copy, however, has a different history. It was kept at Great Smiles.
What do you know?
Right where Micah is. But it was written in Gondor. Probably at the request of the great-grandson of Peregrine. And completed in Shire Reckoning 1592. That would be Fourth Age 172. Brendan, let's get back to the surface-level history of this prologue. If this is surface-level...
Lord...
What do we have to look forward to?
Man, a lot of stuff.
And that is what us as lovers of Tolkien, that's what we're drawn to. So many of us are. Of course, I'm making a generalization, but Micah, that's lore mastery, isn't it? Learning all these things and seeing how huge Middle-earth is. Oh, boy. See, that book was a copy made at the request of King Elisar of the Red Book of the, Perianath, and was brought to him by the Thane Peregrine when he retired to Gondor in the Fourth Age, year 64. The Thane's book was thus the first copy made of the Red Book and contained much that was later omitted or lost. And there was added to it an abbreviated version of those parts of the Tale of Aragorn and Arwen, which lie outside the account of the war. Even more about King Elisar. Wow. And it alone contains the whole of Bilbo's translations from the Elvish. These three volumes were found to be a work of great skill and learning, in which between 1403 and 1418, he had used all the sources available to him in Rivendell, both living and written. Huge! I think that's a good place to wind it down, this discussion. I have so much more to talk about in this prologue, but we leave it to the listeners to be reading along with us.
Well, sure. Gaining,
and then that way we leave room for you to give us feedback and your thoughts and things so that we can share on upcoming episodes. But you know, before we start winding it down, Brendan, what's some thoughts, some additional thoughts? Do you have anything that you'd like to add to or to clarify or to amend?
Not yet.
Are you impressed so far? Are you impressed?
I am, yeah.
So you can already see, yeah, the movies were good, but
wow,
what could they do? What could they do? They could do the best mm-hmm. that they could do,
mm-hmm.
and I do give Peter Jackson credit on the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think he did a fine job. But for you listeners out there, if you've never read the books, join us on this quest. We're going chapter by chapter. You know, next week we'll start off with a long-expected party. There's going to be much to talk about. So read up. Read ahead of time. So you don't have nothing else?
We need say no more. We'd best get a move on. There are still goblins about.
Oh, bother. More mountains?
No. Don't you see? The sun is setting in the west, behind the mountains. We're on the other side, to the edge of the land beyond.
Gandalf says it's time to go, and so I'm going to heed his wishes. I left out some things that maybe I'll be able to bring up on the next episode. Some neat beginning thoughts from that that book I talked about on our introductory episode, Finding God in the Lord of the Rings. Interesting things. But for now, give us feedback. What did you find that was important, apropos, poignant from the prologue? We didn't really get into pipe lore, right? Or the what is it? The arranging of the Shire, or what was that section that I skipped right past because I wanted to, the section on the finding of the ring where Tolkien had to amend some things. It's the ordering of the Shire is the section three that I was thinking of. But Tolkien had to amend some things from the earliest editions of The Hobbit, namely in the Finding of the Ring, the Riddles in the Dark, and what took place between Bilbo and Gollum.
Yes.
But anyway, we can't touch on every single thing that we'd like to on these episodes, we leave the room for you to share your thoughts with us, and we'll give you all the ways to contact us here in just a moment. But we have some feedback that we got on the introductory episode, which was episode zero. So it's kind of funny to refer to an episode that's zero. But Douglas Underhill left a comment on Secret Fire Sent to Burn at the Heart of the World at gctnetwork.com.
I'm excited about this podcast, he says. Can you have it available through Podcast Republic? That just happens to be what I like to use for podcasts. But regardless, bring the Tolkien.
Hey, can we have it available on Podcast Republic, Brendan?
You know, that's an excellent question. I forgot to look.
Oh!
because it was actually on Douglas's suggestion.
Yes.
Using Podcast Republic for Android. That's what I have.
Yes.
So, I mean, hey.
So you went and downloaded that app.
Yes, and let me see.
As Brendan is looking right now in his new favorite podcast aggregator, let you know that we are available in iTunes. We are available on Google Play Music. We are available on Stitcher Radio. And most of these podcast aggregators, most of them actually get the feed from iTunes. So once it's available in iTunes, Brendan, is it available in Podcast Republic?
It most certainly is.
Yay! All the hobbits say yay. You know, Douglas Underhill, you may now subscribe to...
Is it Underhill or Undersell?
No, that was a typing autocorrect.
Oh.
He's Underhill.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Underhill. Sorry. Mr. Underhill.
Okay, all right.
Barlamin Butterbur. Underhill. That seems like that should strike... Well, we'll find out more about that as we go on, too. Brendan doesn't know all these memes.
No, sorry.
No. Anyway, that's what we're doing here on the Secret Fire Podcast, and right?
That's right? It.
So next week, what are we talking about?
Well, the first chapter.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. But before we leave, we have some party invitations to send out. The Secret Fire Podcast is live each Friday, Lord willing, at about 6 p.m. Eastern Time, except for today, Saturday. We explained all that at the top of the show. And we're live in the GCT Network studio. You can join us for video and chat at gctnetwork.com.
/live.
Yes.
And as Michael already said, if you want to join us on Lord of the Rings Online, we are on the Arkenstone server.
We are. Micah is right. Where are you now? Are you still at the Great Smiles? Reading books?
Yes, I am.
Micah's reading books. So to find out more about the Secret Fire Podcast, as well as other shows that we do, including Finding Christ in Cinema and our brothers in Texas,
the Theonauts.
Oh, and if you're not used to our echo, that is the Theonauts Podcast. You can find both of those and all the things that we're doing over at gctnetwork.com. You can send us email to secretfire@gctnetwork.com.
You can call us up on the Hobbit hotline at 507-407-GCTN, or the secondary and not as popular Hobbit hotline at 507-407-4286. Now, let's say you just want to listen to the good old podcast.
I do.
You can go to iTunes, you can go to Google Play Music, you can go to Stitcher Radio, or your favorite podcast catcher such as Podcast Republic, and search them all for the Secret Fire Podcast. Oh, hey, now check it out on social media, too.
Okay, good.
We're at Facebook at facebook.com/Secret Fire Podcast or Twitter at Secret Fire Cast.
Yes. Our theme song is Hobbit's Dance, taken from the album Memories of Middle Earth by Brobdingnagian Bards. Find out more about them, buy CDs, digital music, all that good stuff. Visit their website at thebards.net. And until next time, where is it? Until next time.
This is the end. I'm going away. I'm leaving. Now, goodbye.
Yep.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time on the Secret Fire Podcast. Say goodbye, you guys.
Bye.
Goodbye, guys. Yes.
You are tuned in to the GCT Network.
This is your Great Commission. This is your Great Commission transmission.
At GCTnetwork.com.
Broadcasting from the Three Farthing Stone in the Shire, Middle Earth, this is the Secret Fire Podcast, sent to burn at the heart of the world, episode number one. I'm Michael.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Micah.
On this episode, we'll take a closer... No, take two.
Was it me?
Closer look at the Silver Screen Classics. I was starting
You're going there. Oh, I was that's funny.
I was veering in that direction. Take two. Broadcasting from the Three Farthing Stone in the Shire, Middle Earth, this is the Secret Fire Podcast, sent to burn at the heart of the world, episode number one. I'm Michael.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Micah.
On this episode, we'll take a look at the... I almost did... I'm doing it again. I shouldn't have done that.
Here, just look. Just
we'll take a look at the prologue. There we go. That's all we're doing. Not a closer look.